Concordia Publishing House's annual warehouse sale is both online and in store. Take advantage of discounted prices on many of the items you hear promoted on Issues Etc. November 4th through 10th, and join us for a live broadcast from CPH on Thursday afternoon, November the 5th. Concordia Publishing House's warehouse sale online and in store, cph.org, and 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis. Concordia Publishing House's warehouse sale, November 4th through 10th.
So I'm standing in the gateway of Sodom, and the Genesis 10 gate, which goes all the way back way before the time of Abraham, the opening is from here to here, and you can see these mud bricks right here. This is the face of the wall of the entryway, and so the central access, you'd walk right into the city from this direction and in.
As archaeologist Stephen Collins speaking in a video about the Tal el Hamon site in Jordan, where he claims the biblical cities of Sodom and Gomorrah were located, that's made big news. Now, there's a couple of questions when it comes to biblical archaeology. You first have to ask the question, is this likely the site? People set as a life's goal to locate things like this, and sometimes it just becomes kind of wish fulfillment. They found something. There's no doubt he's found something. Has he found Sodom and Gomorrah? Does it square with the biblical evidence? And then what does it tell us? In addition to what the Bible tells us about these ancient cities that God destroyed at one time during the era of Abraham, as you remember. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live this Friday afternoon, October the 23rd. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Dr. Andrew Steinman's going to join us to talk about archaeological attempts to find Sodom and Gomorrah and the latest claim toward that as well. A little bit later, Pastor Stanley Stanish will join us. We're going to talk about a Hindu goat-killing festival, and it's a strange thing. In a religion where animals are generally revered, to have a lot of bloodletting going on at this point. Goats are being killed by the tens and hundreds of thousands. Why? It's an odd thing, but we'll talk about it with Pastor Stanley Stanish. Then a little bit later, Dr. John Vicker joins us. On the 26th of October, we'll be remembering Lutheran hymn writers Philip Nicolai, Johann Hermann, and Paul Gerhardt. We'll talk about those three men, those three pastors, theologians, and hymn writers, with Dr. John Vicker, formerly served as assistant to the director of the LCMS Commission on Worship, currently the senior assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Then it's Friday. We're going to play Issues Etc. soundbite of the week in the last half hour. It's a game we like to play with our listeners where we line up four soundbites from this week's Issues Etc. audio. We play them for you, you listen, and then you give us a call, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. You send us an email, talkback@issuesztc.org, a tweet at issuesztc, or you go to our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, and you vote for Issues Etc. soundbite of the week. That's the last half hour of Issues Etc. on this Friday afternoon. Joining us to talk about archaeological attempts to find Sodom and Gomorrah, Dr. Andrew Steinman, professor of theology and Hebrew at Concordia University of Chicago, author of the book From Abraham to Paul, A Biblical Chronology. Dr. Steinman, welcome back.
Good to be back with you, Todd.
If you look at what the claims are being made, the location, match it up against the biblical data that we have on these two ancient cities, do you think that there's a good chance, possibility they found the biblical Sodom and Gomorrah?
Well, I think it's a definite possibility. It's in the right area. It's northeast of the Dead Sea, which, as far as I can tell, is what is meant by the Plain of the Jordan, where these cities were. It's at the right time period. The excavation seems to place it, you know, in the right time period, in the Bronze Age. But we don't have, you know, like welcome to Sodom sign or something that can definitively tell us that it was Sodom.
What do you have as an archaeologist when you're dealing with Bronze Age civilization, artifacts, the leftovers of cities like this? It's kind of noted that we have a lot of New Testament archaeology and a lot less Old Testament archaeology. What's going on there?
Well, part of the reason we have less is simply it's so much older, and obviously the more time goes by, the more things are destroyed and lost. Mainly, you know, the most important things they get out of these excavations are pottery, and from pottery they can do a lot of dating. Styles change over time. Technology for producing pottery changes over time, and so with finding pottery, they can be fairly accurate as to when a particular portion of a city was in existence. And so that's the main thing they're using here. Other things are found. Obviously, they will find things like animal bones. They can tell what kind of animals were being eaten and the bones disposed of. They sometimes can find seeds from plants, maybe even wheat or barley that was stored. And I don't know that they've done that in this case, but sometimes that's helpful for carbon dating to help give us a date on things. But I haven't seen any indication of that from this site. Most of what archaeologists get require a good deal of interpretation. They usually don't come across an inscription that is written in a language that we can understand, that we can use. Most of the time we are getting just the day-to-day bric-a-brac that people used, and we have to know from its form, from the way it was made, what time period it's from. And that leaves a lot of room for interpretation and a lot of room for people to make claims that, for instance, that this city could have been biblical Sodom. It meets a lot of the requirements. It's a larger city. It's in the right area. It's in the right time period. But there were other cities there. I mean, the Bible mentions five cities of the plain, Sodom apparently being the most important one. But the biblical text doesn't, you know, rank them by size and say that Sodom was the biggest and Zoar was the smallest or something, and that we can therefore go to this city and say, well, it's a very big city, likely the biggest one in the area at this time, therefore it must be Sodom. And even if we did that, there'd be a good deal of uncertainty. So until we get an inscription or something else that definitively says this is Sodom, there's going to be, I guess, a reasonable doubt as to whether we've actually found the city.
So there's a lot of surmising going on here. And, I mean, I'm thinking about Sodom and Gomorrah in terms of what you would find that would give you any indication. Would it be a king's name? The kind of things that get inscribed, because, like you say, there isn't going to be the welcome sign outside. There's not a physical description of the city itself, so there's nothing there. Would it be a king's name? Would it be something along those lines?
Yeah, generally, the most common thing that you might find would be some type of monument set up by a king proclaiming his rule, maybe how he ruled justly or rightly, or proclaiming his victory, things like that. Those are fairly rare in Palestine. We do have a few examples. All the examples that I can think of offhand are from a much later period of time. The other thing we might run across is an archive on clay tablets. If they were inscribing things on clay tablets as they did over in Mesopotamia, over in Babylon or Assyria, then we might find clay tablets. If the city burned, it baked the clay tablets, you know, they become hard and oftentimes preserved, and we can read them. And we have some things from Palestine, you know, during the Old Testament period that are like that. But apparently they haven't found any of that here at this site. A lot of it depends on, you know, exactly what the ruler of Sodom would have at his disposal. And we don't know that from the biblical text. Would he have been a prosperous enough king to have employed court scribes to keep records of his reign? If he was, and he did, we might at one point find something like that. But that's pure speculation. We simply don't know that those such things ever existed.
So the real dilemma for the archaeologist is he's always kind of matching his desire to get, to assemble the best evidence with the fact that there is very, very little real kind of hard evidence for hard conclusions when it comes to something like this.
Yeah, and you know, it would be much more persuasive, I suppose. We know that there were five cities of the plain that were destroyed when Lot fled. And so if we found five cities that were all seen to be destroyed about the same time, you know, in the right place of the right era, then we might say, well, we don't know for sure which one was Sodom, which one was Gomorrah, which one was whatever. But it seems to match the biblical evidence as far as we could push the biblical evidence. So then we'd be a lot more confident. Even then, there'd be a degree of doubt.
What were the cities, what do we do know from the biblical account of Sodom and Gomorrah? Where do they come into the biblical picture? I think they're there, obviously, in Abraham's story, but elsewhere as well.
Yeah, well, we first encounter them with Lot and Abraham, where Abraham proposes that they go their separate ways because their flocks have gotten so large and their shepherds are fighting with one another. And we're told that Lot looks over and sees that the plain of the Jordan River is well watered everywhere, and he chooses that. Well, telling us it was the plain of the Jordan River is important because that seems to indicate, you know, a place. Other indications of this place are found later in Scripture. And so we have the plain of the Jordan mentioned again. I believe it's in the book of Kings. And it mentions the cities of Succoth and Zarethan as being in the plain at that period of time, much later. But that, again, puts us in the region north of the Jordan River, I mean north of the Dead Sea along the Jordan River. This is, and we have a very interesting word for plain here. It's actually the Hebrew word that can also mean circle. It's actually used in other places to mean a crown, because a crown is kind of like a circle, right, that the king puts on his head. So we're probably talking about a plain that was roughly circular, and that would fit kind of the lower Jordan as it's going into the Dead Sea. But otherwise, we don't encounter, you know, these cities or this region very often in the biblical text, because Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed. Sodom and Gomorrah are mentioned several times, for instance, in the Psalms, as examples of wickedness, and we know they're mentioned in the New Testament. You know, Jesus mentions the men of Sodom arising and condemning the people of his age. But these are all looking back on these cities that were destroyed. So we have very little mention of these cities as historical cities set in a particular historical period, kind of a discussion of their ongoing history, and we have very little outside the book of Genesis.
What is the, well, we'll take this up on the other side of the break, but what I'm curious about is the destruction that they suffer there seems pretty severe at the hand of God after much warning during the Abraham story. Would that account for the fact that the cities appear just simply to have been lost at that point, lost to memory at that point? Well, answer that question with Dr. Andrew Steinman, talking about the archaeological attempts to find Sodom and Gomorrah, a claim that one of these cities has been found. Stay tuned. A daily dose of Luther is good for the soul. The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for October is a new devotional resource, Day by Day with Martin Luther. You can find out more at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040, 800-325-3040. Day by Day with Martin Luther costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for October, Day by Day with Martin Luther.
LutheranReformation.org is the brand new one-stop shop for all things Reformation. It's your source for news, events, history, videos, activities, educational resources, and much, much more. New resources will be added regularly, each one designed to help you celebrate and remember the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. Because Reformation 2017 is still all about Jesus. Visit LutheranReformation.org today. LutheranReformation.org.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Throughout the history of the United States, we as a country have enjoyed our catchphrases from give me liberty or give me death to today's classic, it is what it is. TV commercials have added such classics as where's the beef to eat fresh. Here at St. Mark Lutheran Church in Edmond, Oklahoma, we do not resort to catchphrases. Here we are about growing God's family by preaching God's word, by administering the sacraments, and building up God's people. So the next time you find yourself in central Oklahoma on a Sunday morning, come join the friendly folks at St. Mark in Edmond. You'll be glad you did. This is most certainly true.
Christ is the one who has borne all your anxieties, has taken them into his person, every worry, and he crucified it once and for all.
Listen to chapel services live weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilby. We're talking about the alleged discovery of Sodom and Gomorrah by an archaeologist. Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest. He's professor of theology and Hebrew at Concordia University, Chicago, author of the book From Abraham to Paul, A Biblical Chronology. One of the things that really helps the study of the Old Testament and the New Testament, especially the Old Testament, where the chronology, even the order of the events sometimes confuses us, is a good, solid timeline. And that is exactly what is provided by Dr. Andrew Steinman in this book, From Abraham to Paul, A Biblical Chronology. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Call Concordia Publishing House and order the book. It's a great resource. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Ask for From Abraham to Paul, A Biblical Chronology. Dr. Steinman, what does the Old Testament account tell us about the cities themselves and then why the rationale behind their destruction at the hands of God during the story of Abraham?
Okay, well, the cities themselves are identified as kind of one of the borders of Canaan, apparently the eastern border. It's mentioned when the Canaanites are kind of discussed in their borders in Genesis 10. So they were probably Canaanite cities and probably therefore involved in all the pagan type of practices that were going on among the Canaanites in Abraham's day. We meet them again, as I said, when Lot chooses to go there. We find that they were subjected to some kings from Mesopotamia, and they rebelled. They were their subjects for 12 years. In the 13th year, we're told, they rebelled, and there was a big battle in this Jordan Valley, and the cities there in the plain lost, and the Mesopotamians grabbed Lot and his family and wanted to run back to Mesopotamia with them, but Abraham raises an army and rescues Lot, and Lot goes back to living in Sodom and Gomorrah, and it's at that point when we pick it up again, that we learn that God is angry with Sodom and Gomorrah for their sins, and he is going to destroy these cities. And we get the well-known story of Abraham pleading with God, really bargaining with God about not destroying the cities if so many righteous men were found in the city. And he, you know, talks from a higher number down to a lower number. And then we get this account of the two angels God sends down into the city to rescue Lot and his family. Apparently, from the stories in the Bible, their sins, one of their sins, were sexual ones, because it looks as if the men of Sodom were asking, when Lot is there, are asking and demanding that he be brought out and they could have sex with him. So it appears to be a sin condemned in the Bible, homosexuality. That was one of the things that upset God about the city, and there were probably many others. Knowing what we know about Canaanite worship, it was not unusual for them to practice child sacrifice, to practice prostitution in their temples, both male and female. So there was probably plenty that God was disgusted with these cities, and they may have been the worst examples of Canaanite practices during their day, and that may be what caused God to condemn them. And so we get the story of the angels rescuing Lot and his daughters from the city, and of course they were told not to look back when God destroyed four of the five cities of the plain. And we get the account of Lot's wife looking backwards, being turned into a pillar of salt, while Lot and his children escaped to the fifth city of the plain, apparently the smallest one, Zoar, where further things happen then.
So do they ever resurface again, except by kind of... you know, as you mentioned before, Christ mentioning them, parabolic reference. Is there any evidence in the biblical account that these cities are rebuilt or anything like that?
No, and in fact, as late as Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, the city of Sodom and sometimes also Gomorrah are used as examples of wickedness that were wiped off the face of the earth. So, very late in the Old Testament, these prophets mention them. I believe Amos mentions it once, and Zephaniah once. But there, as late as some of the latest prophets in the Old Testament, these cities are still kind of bywords for cities that God completely wiped out for their wickedness. And apparently, no one ever again dare build them. Perhaps with God's destruction came a change so that it was not advantageous to build a city there anymore. Maybe God also changed the geography of the place such that people decided that it was better to live elsewhere.
So I'm wondering, just in terms of kind of the grand story of the Old Testament, this is kind of judgment on the Canaanites long, long, long before God carries out that judgment on the Canaanites with Abraham's descendants, who are kind of dwelling in him by promise. I wonder if that story functions there in the mind of the Old Testament author, Moses in this case, to as a way of teaching the people before they enter the land that God has already judged those people and this land already, even at Abraham's time, belongs to them.
I think you're on to something there. I think it is a way of saying to Israel before they go into the land, and they're told specifically, don't tolerate the Canaanites, don't tolerate their practices, destroy them. And I think the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah is a picture of God's wrath against some of these very corrupt Canaanite practices that I talked about earlier. And we're told already in the book of Genesis that God was going to use Abraham's descendants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob's descendants, to punish the Canaanites for their sins, that when Israel came back, the sins of the Canaanites would be full in God's eyes, and he would use Israel to judge them. Of course, we know what happens, and God warned them, and Joshua eventually will repeat this warning. God warned them that if they don't wipe out the Canaanites, they'll end up being like them and partaking in their sins. And, of course, this is why later prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel talk about Sodom and Gomorrah, because the sins of the Canaanites became the sins of the Israelites because they tolerated these people in their midst.
So there's a real, this isn't just kind of a smoke and light show of the Old Testament. The story is there as kind of the warning to God's people who are headed back to this place, who are hearing these stories from Moses by divine revelation, and are being taught what God intends for them.
Yeah, and it is indeed a kind of a horrific story when you read about it, and I think really deeply think about what the words say about God's destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. They really are a very stark warning about exactly how disgusting some of these sins were to God. And they were intended, I think, to show Israel, that God was very serious about punishing these sins, and he's very serious about his people not taking up the sins of the of people among whom they would be living, and why God told them, in this case, to wipe them out and warn them if they lived among them, they likely would pick up their sins. I think it's interesting, too, in our New Testament setting, our setting today, we have no mandate to wipe out, people who are doing similar sins today. But the New Testament warns us over and over again not to partake in such sins. You can hardly get out of the first chapter of the book of Romans and not draw that conclusion that we're not to do these type of things. And so even though we don't have a mandate to wipe anybody out instead to bring them the gospel of Christ and rescue them from these corrupt practices, there's also a warning here for us, lest we think that we can tolerate these sins in any way and not ourselves be affected by them and perhaps be pulled out of the faith and under the wrath of God if we are too tolerant, in the sense that we begin to think that they're all right or that we can partake in them.
Let's talk a little bit about kind of the nature of this discovery. Come back to it if we could. If it can be established in some way as a very reasonable, I think it's probably all the more we can do, a very reasonable candidate for Sodom and Gomorrah, say they do find five distinct cities here or the evidence for it, how significant would that be in terms of Old Testament archaeology?
I think it would be very significant if we could make a strong case for the cities of the plain, and that they're at the correct time, the time the Bible indicates, and in the correct place. Then I think it makes a case for the fact that the stories that we have in Genesis, the story about Abraham and Lot and so forth, that these are not, as some scholars want to say, just made up. Later legends made up just to try to substantiate Israel as a people, but rather they're likely real recollections, accurate recollections of what happened. And accurate, of course, we would say, because, of course, God inspired the text. God saw to it that Moses had accurate information when he wrote. But I think we could begin to make a case and say, look, at people for several centuries now have doubted whether Abraham ever existed, whether these stories were ever anything other than legend and kind of like Aesop's fables to tell a moral of some type. We can say no. If we could substantiate these to a high degree, we could say no, these are actual things that happened in history. And that's important for us as Christians, because we know that God acts in history for our benefit. He began doing that in the Old Testament. It culminated, of course, with Christ coming into our world in history in human flesh. And so I think it makes a great apologetic for the fact that Christianity talks about a God who loves us so much, he's willing to break into our world and use our history to call us to himself and to reconcile us, despite the fact that we've run the other direction. No other religion in the world is so tied to historical events and claims that God is working through those historical events for the benefit of humankind. And I think this would be another way that we could, bring the facts of history into service of the gospel.
Is it at the same time, as a student of this history and as someone who has delved into the places and the times in your extensive research, is it a bit frustrating to know that in all likelihood with a case like this, a significant find, you'll never really know for sure?
It is somewhat frustrating. But on the other hand, we live in a time where we've been fairly well blessed with evidence for other things in the Old Testament. Evidence of, and in recent years have come out pointing to the real existence of David. We have great evidence now for many of the later people in the Old Testament, Hezekiah, Baruch, Jeremiah, many of the people mentioned we might think of them as minor characters in the Book of Kings or Chronicles. We actually have now any number of people who we have found artifacts from that we can say belong to those people because it has their name on it. So it's not as if we're without evidence, and we can use that other evidence that has come out in the past, 50, 100 years, to good effect if we're aware of it. And so it is frustrating. I'd love to have something from Abraham today, because what has happened is people 200 years ago were doubting, you had biblical scholars doubting whether anything in the Old Testament existed. 50 years ago, they were doubting whether David really existed. Okay, we'll give you the later kings, but not David or something in his era. Well, now we've pushed it back to David's era. It would be wonderful to have something to push it back and say, here we have something that we can substantiate Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Rebecca. But even without that, I think we can say we have good indications that the biblical writers were not making this up. They weren't embellishing the truth. They weren't taking general truths and making up characters to illustrate points. They were actually talking about real people who existed in time, as the church has always taught from the beginning.
So one last question for you here. Had we begun the archaeological enterprise, say, and this is highly speculative, but I'm curious because you make me wonder this, had we begun the archaeological enterprise 200 years earlier and gotten farther along with finding some of these sites, do you think that the liberal Bible scholarship of the 18th and the 19th, 20th century, really the 19th and 20th, would have been able to catch hold as much as it did? Because it was basically arguing from silence most of the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, a lot of these arguments that were came up was, well, we don't have any evidence, so it's not there. It didn't happen. So maybe, but on the other hand, we wouldn't have had the technology that we have nowadays that sometimes help us in archaeology. And, once you dig these things up, you only get one chance to dig them up and analyze them. It's not like you can repeat the experiment, because once you dig up a pot, it's not there to dig up again. So in some sense, maybe these things happened in a good period of history because of the technological advances that God has also given us. It's a shame that, many, many people are relying on skepticism of the Bible that, as you say, grew up in a time when we didn't know any of this, and it was easy to argue that this was all made up. And unfortunately, much of the world and even much of the scholarly world has not caught up with what we now know archaeologically. Many of these theories simply would never have come into being. You're right about that, and you kind of wish that they wouldn't have come into being, because they wouldn't have had the ammunition of saying, these didn't exist, we have no evidence for it.
Dr. Andrew Steinman is professor of theology and Hebrew at Concordia University, Chicago. He's author of the book From Abraham to Paul, A Biblical Chronology. Dr. Steinman, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you, Todd.
After the break, we're going to spend some time with Pastor Stanley Stanish, pastor in the India Evangelical Lutheran Church, a PhD candidate at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. We're going to talk about a Hindu goat-killing festival that is, well, it's a bloody affair, especially in a nation and, in fact, in a religion that generally has a hands-off policy towards animals. They're killing goats by the hundreds of thousands during this 15-day festival of Dashain. Stay tuned. We'll talk about it.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Mount Zion Lutheran, Greenfield, Wisconsin. Pilgrim Lutheran, West Bend, Wisconsin. Messiah Lutheran, Lebanon, Illinois. Zion Lutheran, Accident, Maryland. Redeemer Lutheran, Jackson, Wyoming. Messiah Lutheran, Marysville, Washington. Trinity Lutheran, Millstadt, Illinois. Our Savior Lutheran, Houston, Texas. St. Matthew's Lutheran, Bon Terre, Missouri. Good Shepherd Lutheran, Lincoln, Nebraska. Hope Lutheran, St. Louis, Missouri. Trinity Lutheran, Austin, Texas. Good Shepherd Lutheran, Collinsville, Illinois. Luther Memorial Chapel, Shorewood, Wisconsin. Christ Lutheran, Oak Park, Illinois. Bethany Lutheran, Naperville, Illinois. And Emmanuel Lutheran, Dearborn, Michigan. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget at our website, issuesetc.org. Click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
The 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Reformation is fast approaching. We have such a rich history as Lutherans, and many people don't realize that. The CLCC offers a seminar called Your Reformation Walk that teaches that rich heritage and helps you appreciate it. The CLCC also offers other seminars designed to help laity learn to appreciate what Lutherans believe, teach, and confess. So invite us to your church. Visit theclcc.org and get details on scheduling a seminar for your church today.
Expert guests. Expansive topics. Extolling Christ. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In 1521, at the Diet of Worms, Martin Luther was asked to recant his writings. Luther responded, "Unless I am convinced from the sacred scriptures that I am in error, I cannot and will not recant. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me. Amen." Will you stand with us as we proclaim these Reformation truths in the 21st century? You can take your stand by becoming a monthly or annual contributor to Issues Etc. To find out how you can become an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron, check out the donate page of our website, issuesetc.org. Just look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Help us proclaim the solas of the Reformation, Scripture, faith, grace, and Christ alone. Here we stand, Issues Etc. and you.